consider to England or France. You may like to gamble, you might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion.
And welcome back. I'm Dr. Lawrence Brown, sitting in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Whether you're downtown or around town, thank you for joining us. That was Bob Dylan performing Gotta Serve Somebody in 1979. He hit the top 40s chart with this song. Join John Tegler, host of WEAA Straight Jazz Ahead, for a conversation on the Great American Songbook, the music that makes up the foundation of jazz. Panelists include Baltimore's Jazz Alliance, big band founder Anthony Villa, trumpeter and educator John Lampkin, and renowned jazz pianist Larry Willis. The conversation will be followed by a jam session featuring our panelists. This event is a part of WEAA's lecture series, bringing the conversations on the arts to the community. Thursday, October 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the Walters Art Museum. For more information and tickets, call 410-547-9000 or visit walters.org. We're so happy to be with you today. We have in the studio with us A. Adar Ayura, project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships. Good morning.
How are you today?
Doing great, doing great.
Excellent.
And we also have in the studio with us Greg Klein, attorney, co-founder, and contributing editor for Red Maryland, host of the Conservative Refugee Podcast, and co-host of Red Maryland Radio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we want to make sure you join us in this conversation. Call us with your comments at 410-319-8888. Email your thoughts to talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner and comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. Well, let's get right into it. Recently, there's been a controversy in Colorado. The school board there in Jefferson County has been wrangling over the AP history framework that was released, and they've been arguing about what should be taught in that school's systems, in the school system there. And so I want to read what Julie Williams, the chair of the board, said. She said, "Materials should promote citizenship, patriotism, essentials, and benefits of the free enterprise system, respect for authority, and respect for individual rights. Materials should not encourage or condone civil disorder, social strife, or disregard of the law." And then she added elsewhere, "I don't think we should encourage our kids to be little rebels." Greg, I'll start with you. What do you make of this, and what does it mean for our society and our children's education?
Well, first off, I think even in the article that we're talking about here, they acknowledge that initially they might have gone a little too far in trying to do this. Look, this is an elected school board who's reviewing something that is inherently subjective, which is the study of history and how history is presented and taught to our kids. You know, there's a certain amount of education that is unavoidably indoctrination, and history seems to be, you know, kind of a ground zero for that. So, you know, I don't think it's unusual or inappropriate for an elected school board to look at this stuff. Some of her comments, you know, I mean, the history of our country is that people have, you know, we've had this strife, and that's part of our history. So I don't know that we can excise that or that's inappropriate, especially for kids who are taking AP history. But you know, I'll tell you this. I have a 16-year-old daughter who's taking AP history classes, you know, and I have a degree in political science and history. So, you know, I look at what she's being taught, and I know, you know, that's one point of view. So I think it's appropriate when you have public school elected officials to look at this and to have some input and to have some discussion. They have a very vibrant discussion that's going on in Colorado about what it is we're teaching our kids and what it is they should be learning. I don't know that what you just read is what the touchstone ought to be ultimately, but I think a discussion is appropriate and a review is appropriate.
All right. Sister Adar, where do you stand on this?
There has always been controversy, if you will, on what frame, what narrative is going to be taught as the national narrative of our country. And a lot of that national narrative begins with what we are taught as history. And we know that that in this country, history has been a tool beyond an educational tool. And she puts it on the table what, in her view, is the appropriate role of school. And her view is what has been the appropriate role of school. So what is very interesting is that there are certain times where this whole conversation bubbles up. What history? Whose history? What is that history going to look like? And this is one of those times.
Well, you know, it's interesting. She said that material should not encourage or condone civil disorder, social strife, or disregard of the law. Is the teaching of the conflicts that have happened in American history, is that likely to engender this sort of behavior from our children?
I think it's unavoidable that you're teaching some sort of strife. So I wouldn't agree with that, obviously. But look, there are different history books. I mean, if you teach these kids out of the People's History of the United States, they're going to get a very different view of it than they would from some other history book. It is, and I think we all agree on this, history is by its nature subjective. And when you have public school kids who are being taught history, there's a certain amount of indoctrination that goes on. So again, it's appropriate to have the discussion. No, I don't think you can understand American history without understanding some strife. Now, having said that, does that mean that you teach the entire history of the country, like on the show we just had prior to this one, where everything's from a class point of view? And it's, you know, I don't know that that's appropriate either to be teaching teaching high school kids. But yeah, I don't think everybody becomes a rebel because they learn that we had strife in this country, because that's, you know, there's no avoiding that.
Where do you stand on this question, Adar, where whether or not strife is likely to emerge out of teaching the conflicts and the organizing that has taken place in American history? Is that likely to emerge from our youth?
If we are lucky, it will. Because we should be teaching our youth how to think. We should be teaching it how to think. And one person's strife, and that word in itself is a characterization, is another person's righteous battle against injustice. And our history has been filled with righteous battles against injustice that many people have characterized as strife. If we are lucky, what our youth will learn is how to be critical thinkers and how to take action when they see injustice, regardless of where that injustice occurs, in their own backyards or in the larger country.
Well, let's take a step back. You know, when you think about, you know, this is not just happening in Colorado. In Texas, sure, there was some controversy a couple of years ago. There's been a great contestation for over education in the past few years. How are we to view this in terms of education policy and the strife that's taking place, you know, the battle for education, the battle for the minds of our children? Adar, where do you see this battle taking us in the future?
Well, again, that battle, quote unquote, has always been there. And there is a reaction, and that reaction has to do with the changing demographics of this country and our public schools. Specifically our public schools and the students in our public schools being more students of color, mm-hmm, right? And so when we look at what is going on in our country as a whole, because it's not just about school, what is going on in the school and the questions that are being asked in terms of AP history and what we teach and how we teach is a reaction to the larger issue of what is going on in this country.
You know, and one of the larger issues, Greg, I've been looking at this report, Death by a Thousand Cuts, talking about the closure of so many schools around the country, public schools especially, and how this affects communities. A lot of this happening in low income, minorities of color, people of color that attend these schools. Is there a way that you can explain how these larger forces of school closures and even the education policy battles are linked, perhaps?
Well, I don't know that they're linked. I know the piece that you gave kind of think that they were linked. I think you're exactly right. The battles as far as what we're teaching our kids is not new. I think that something along the lines of what Colorado is promoting is probably was status quo for decades. You know, it was citizenship preparedness. It was, you know, a certain view of the history of the United States. That's been replaced to some degree, and there is some pushback. And it's reflective of a culture at large that is debating who we are and what we're about, which, again, is nothing new. As far as the funding goes, look, we spend an extraordinary amount of money on public education in this country. And a lot of the places that the article mentioned where there's school closures are some of the places where there is an enormous amount being spent, where there's control by people who believe in larger expenditures of public funds. I think the reality, coming from a more conservative perspective, I think the reality is we've got to look at whether more and more monopolistic public education is the right way to go, whether giving people, especially in inner cities and in other places, more opportunities for school choice and to take other options in all those forms, whether that wouldn't help the problem. Not just and the idea of just expanding schools, making them bigger, spending more and more money. I think we've got enough evidence now that just isn't going to work.
Well, what about this idea? You know, our school systems are becoming increasingly privatized. More and more charter schools, a lot of our schools are bringing in more Teach for America graduates as opposed to licensed teachers who've gone through the rigorous process of learning how to teach. Is not the way that education policy is being positioned from this sort of free market perspective, is that not like hand in hand with what's happening in the market of education itself?
When we're looking at education, part of the danger is looking at it in piecemeal. Let's look at how much money is spent per student in the school. Let's look at whether we should continue to invest in private schools or in charter schools, blah, blah, blah. We need to look at the system as a whole. And there are a couple things that are happening. We have neighborhoods that are under-resourced. So the schools do not exist in a vacuum. They exist in a greater environmental landscape, which we also need to look at and address. When children go to school and they are hungry, that they cannot learn. That is not a good way of learn. We need to look at teacher preparation. When we look at schools that are under-resourced, those are the schools where we send the new teachers. We need to look at who the teachers are. 84% of our teachers teaching in public schools, coming into teaching, are white women. When we have a school consumers, the students that are in public schools, mostly students of color. We need to look at all of those things, and teacher preparation is key. When teachers have seniority, when they actually know how to teach, know how to engage students, we move them out of the communities that need them most. So while we're looking at this issue, we also need to look at the questions that we're asking so that we can make sure that we're asking the right questions.
Absolutely. Let's take a call. We have Michael from Baltimore. Where do you stand on this issue?
I think this is very instructive because really what's being said here is it's not truly education that's happening in the government schools. It's indoctrination. And my question is, how far does historical revisionism go? For example, if one takes a course in African history, he will discover that it's said that African Americans, or Africans in general, descended from kings and queens. And if one learns from the biblical text, one will understand that the Jewish people maintain that they descended from slaves, that they were all slaves in Egypt. But when you look at the history of Egypt, you'll find there's almost no record of the Jewish people being there. It takes archaeologists to uncover it, because what the Egyptians did was, in their revisionist way, destroy all records of the Jewish people ever being there. And if you go to the Romans, you have such things as Josephus, who speaks about certain events that one might think actually happened, but he was under the control of the revisionists, the Romans. And if one were to trust what Josephus said, when you understand that he could have been killed if he told the truth, then one wouldn't trust history of the Romans, wouldn't trust history of the Egyptians, or trust history at all.
Michael, we want to thank you for calling in. I want to come back to my studio guest here. What about this notion, Greg, of revisionist history? Is that what the AP framework is threatening to teach?
Well, I think there's a certain debate. I mean, there is an entire study of how history is written. I think that's where the debate is, and I think some folks are feeling that there is some pushback on that. I do agree as well that you can't look at schools simply as in the absence. I mean, you do have to look at the environment, the communities, or whatever. That's very true. It's one of the reasons why I think the idea of more investment is going to solve the problem, or continuing to do what we're doing. A lot of these places where we have the most the quote unquote failing schools, or where there's the biggest challenges, are places where you have, frankly, a very homogeneous political environment. You have the same folks running it who are of the same mindset, who've been having and acting the same policies and acting the same proposals for decades, and you really haven't seen any change. And I think there has to be a more vigorous debate about thinking outside of the box that they've been in all of those things. Certainly the communities and the breakdown of family and all those kinds of things are huge contributors to what's going on, which is why the glib kind of response, we need to expand our schools and make them more service-oriented, invest more and more money, isn't going to work, because it isn't going to get to a lot of those problems.
So what about this thought that government control of schools is really a big part of the problem, in addition to the community factors that you just mentioned, Greg? But is the problem really government control of schools, that, you know, we shouldn't be expanding government spending in education?
I think that part of the problem is that there needs to be a more honest reinvestment in public schools. That charter schools, private schools have been created because people want to opt out of the learning that is available for all children. So it continues a two-tier system, which increasingly disadvantages children and disadvantages the economic potential of our youth. And that disadvantages, that truncates the economic viability of our states. And you see these questions in states where you have more Black and brown youth with more of a white power structure. Dr. Manuel Pastor did a great study where he documented the states that where the racially demographic population was changing. And he found that less money is going to the public good in those states where you have youth, a racially changing population with an existing white power structure.
We're going to come back to that very point when we come back from our break. On the way to the break, we're listening to the Jimi Hendrix Experience, covering the Beatles' Day Tripper. They recorded this for the BBC on this day in 1967. Hello, I'm Dr. Lawrence Brown, sitting in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's My Boy Lollipop by Millie Small. She was born on this day in 1948, one of their original ska songs to hit it big in the United States, from what I understand. Before we switch over into this article that came out in Science, I want to come back to this notion. Greg, before we went to break, we were talking about the changing racial demographic and that leading to a lot of the conflict over education, not just education policy, but even resources that are public goods overall. Is that something that you see as a part of this dynamic, or is it something else?
Well, I don't know that is what's driving it. I think there's a political debate about how much money we're spending and whether, you know, government solutions can be the source. If you want to say that's race driven or something, I can see why people might want to try to say that. I don't think that's what's driving it, though. The question is, we're looking at a long history of public education, of these public goods programs, looking at the results and being critical about whether they're having the intended effect. And a lot of places you've had folks in who don't believe that they have been affected have been going to a different model.
And before we switch over, do you want to respond to that? Is it really race driven, or is it, you know, conservative angst about spending, whether or not we're spending too much and we need to be critical of how we're spending our money?
Of course it's race driven. And I don't think that that is the only thing going on. I do think that there is an economic case. But to look at the disparities and to look at who is being harmed and who benefits from those disparities, there's no way that you can say that race does not enter into it at all, and class.
Absolutely. You know, the Science magazine is coming out with a report, an article stating that HIV began in Kinshasa, in the what was then known as Zaire, a Belgian colony at the time, and today it's known as the Democratic Republic of Congo. The article says that scientists have traced the origins of HIV pandemic there to, I guess, about in the 1920s. Where bustling transportation networks, migrant labor, and changes to the sex trade industry created a perfect storm that gave rise to the virus. Adar, what does this tell us? What does this new science tell us about the emergence of deadly diseases in our world today, especially with the way Ebola is now reaching our shores?
I don't know what it tells us. I have no clue. And let me tell you why. Because there are so many factors that goes into research, how people research, the conclusions that they come up with, and we don't know. I mean, to me, it's just like the history conversation. History is written by those with the power to write it. So for the origin of HIV or what that means for Ebola or what, I have no clue, Lawrence, what that means or what that is saying.
All right. Greg, your thoughts?
It was a fascinating article about and I don't know if it's accurate or not either. I think what's interesting about it is it shows that a growing global economy, growing global world where we have more transportation is going to be a nexus for these kinds of diseases to spread. And now we're at a time where we're a little bit more aware of that and can deal with that, which wasn't the case in the time that they're studying. So they were doing all kinds of terrible things that were spreading this very bad disease. We'll see. I'm not as negative as some folks. The potential is there, but I think the processes to deal with it are also there as well. We're going to have more scares. Whether it ends up being these worldwide pandemics that we've seen in the past, I guess we'll see. I certainly hope not, and I'm not expecting it will be.
Well, you know, what about this question? I mean, I think there are two questions that come to my mind. One is the sort of stigma that's attached to Africa when we say all of these diseases emerge from there. I guess, mm-hmm. What are you, yeah, I see you nodding.
Well, I that is why, I mean, when I read a report like this, my first reaction is, oh, wow, typical. Because what we don't get to is we know that there is chemical, viral, and other types of warfare going on. Now, I am not a conspiracy theorist, but we can look at history and we can look at some things that have happened in history medically. We can look at how we try to use viruses and other things as weapons. And so my questions are, okay, what is behind this story? Because nobody has come up with this with a credible theory about how this disease supposedly transmitted itself from chimpanzees or monkeys to humans. And there is this stereotypical meta conversation, the conversation in stereotypes just below the surface that this framing of things buys into.
Right, Greg, do you think that there's any sort of stigma that can be attached to diseases? You know, there's the Spanish flu, the bubonic plague that emerged out of Europe. What about, you know, what we're finding out, HIV out of Africa, Ebola out of Africa? What does this mean in terms of the way diseases are attached to geographic locations?
Well, I think that it does create some. I mean, I can perfectly understand why people would think that way. And you know, we'll see if it affects policymakers. I mean, we're having this big debate now about whether we block flights from Liberia coming in because of this Ebola scare, even though I don't know how many direct flights there are from Liberia to the United States. Yes,
not a lot. They've been blocking, cutting off a lot of the flights.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely there's a stigma. I don't think these things are being, you know, some folks in the community say these are being created by the CIA. I don't think that's what's happening. But yeah, you look at a country that's less developed, that has less of the public health infrastructure, there are all kinds of stereotypes.
It is more ripe for exploitation by forces outside of that country.
Well, that could be as well. I mean, and even in this article, the explanation that's given for how this transmitted was, they kind of just glossed over it, was, you know, bad monkey meat being eaten or somebody, you know, as though that's how folks there eat or at that time ate. So I can totally understand the concern about it. And it is concerning. And you know, it's one of the reasons why, again, I'm not as concerned that we're going to have this worldwide pandemic. There was a lot going on during the same time period. We talk about the Spanish flu. There was a lot going on, war, chemical war, and all that kind of stuff that was going on that contributed to that as well.
And Lawrence, excuse me, because for me, this relates back to our earlier conversation about so-called strife, whether we teach that or whether we want our students to inculcate that. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm saying it is so important for us to develop a system where critical thinking is important. Mm-hmm. Because we do not want anybody to just read an article or read a piece of research and take it at its face value without going deeper and asking questions that go deeper than just the information that we are given.
Well, you know, I agree with that.
One of the things that this article did bring up, and the research does talk about, and the history discusses as well, is that the country Zaire at the time was a colony or had been colonized by Belgium. When we look at West Africa and or Africa in general, the impact of colonization, where does that fit into the question? Where does that fit into, because, you know, these, when you talk about the healthcare system that's underdeveloped, the infrastructure that's not where it should be, might there be a connection between colonization and the way that these systems have developed over time?
Well, I think certainly the article made a good point that there was, and I think at that time, fair to say, much more exploitation going on, that, you know, the sex trade that was coming up because they had so many workers coming in building things, and that was one of the things that contributed to this. You can see that. And this growing transportation infrastructure that was putting more and more people in contact with each other and not creating the countermeasures that would have prevented something like this.
Yeah, I think the hospitals, in a different article I've seen on this, the hospitals helped contribute to the spread of it because they were reusing needles in the hospital. So in many ways, you know, the stigma can be attached to the place, but understanding the history, I guess we understand the other factors that are involved, the hospitals that help contribute, you know, to the spread of the HIV-1 virus. Colonization, what are your thoughts on that? Did that have an impact on the infrastructure and the healthcare system there?
Colonization.
And we're talking about European colonization.
European
of African countries. Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. European colonization has had an impact on each of the 53 countries in the continent, on the continent of Africa. And just to give a specific example, this has nothing to do with Africa, but this is so indicative of the things that happen. When that horrible tragedy occurred in Haiti, right? And American aid workers and other aid workers were run into Haiti, and the narrative of that was, oh, this poor country who just couldn't get itself together, and this is the reason why they were not positioned to deal with this situation when all of this happened. But what people don't know is that Haiti ended up paying $21 billion to France to as reparations, right?
Mm-hmm. For and the French slave owners.
Exactly, right. Exactly. For the loss of the people who enslaved this population. They needed to pay them the economic equivalent of what they lost in by freeing human beings. So what we see now is not just what we see now. There is a huge history behind it. So just as when we talked about what happened in Haiti and their weak infrastructure system, we did not connect it to anything having to do with colonization. We're doing the same thing now when we're seeing the Ebola virus in Africa, the way that it has spread, when we're talking about HIV developing in Africa. We're talking about these countries, these incidents, as if they are standalone periods in time with nothing that has gone before that. And that is simply not true. And that, so, Lawrence, is how European colonization plays in.
So maybe history should be something that we, you know, we could take into account some of these factors. We have a caller, Kadria from Baltimore. Welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Kadria, are you there? All right.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is such a true thing about the history of the European infiltration among the indigenous people of the earth and the diseases. Number one, let me just start with the American so-called Indians. And I say that because the so-called Indians said they had no such word in their language as Indians. They said they told the European people they was people, and they called themselves by the tribe, the names by the tribes, okay? Number one. Number two issue is, I don't know how many people know, the indigenous Indians had no diseases at all in their community until the introduction of the Europeans. They didn't even know what the common cold was. So that's one another issue. And, of course, most people do know that the United States sent General Custer to them with a whole blanket full of smallpox under the guise of gifts, okay? Same thing, I believe, was done in Africa. And just to talk about the education and the miseducation of our people, Egyptian professor told me in 1987 in Chicago, Illinois, University of Illinois, that the Egyptian people had no history at all of enslavement of the Jewish people. Another professor there told me a couple of years later, she gave me an article, and it was linking polio that was given by the United States to the African countries and the link to HIV. Virus, okay?
Kadria, we want to thank you for calling. I want to bring the discussion back to my guest here in the studio. First, let me say, of course, I do know that American Indians did have some diseases here. It's just they have exposure to like influenza and smallpox. But I think there's a larger question about conspiracy beliefs in medicine. Adar.
Listen, I think one good point that she made, again, is that, Kadria mm-hmm. was her name, is that, you know, we can't just look at this in a vacuum and get a true story. That the issues, the factors are much more complex than our news cycles allow, and that we need to begin to build that complexity into the ways in which we talk about things that are happening today.
Right. You know,
let me just jump in on that because sure. I'm curious about that. How does that manifest itself then, and how should we be talking about it? I mean, these countries, we don't have early 20th century style colonialism going on.
Mm-hmm.
These countries have been independent for decades.
Mm-hmm.
How should it be different, other than understanding there's a history and a context here? What is it people should be understanding that's different about these countries now, or how they're dealing with this, or how we're dealing with
it? I think that people should understand the relationship of these countries to the United States. I think that they need to understand the United States' role in engagement with these countries, and I think that they need to understand that these countries, the 47 or the 53 when you include the island countries, that they are independent agents and that they do not need the noblesse oblige United States engagement. One thing, when I talk to leaders from African countries who come to the United States, they always say, we need people to engage with us, not for us. And instead of people coming to our country telling us how we should do things, they need to listen to what we are doing and to our ideas, not come like big brother or like father and saying we know best, because they don't. And the United States would not want any other country coming into our country telling us what we should do in our country and for our country. Sure. But yet we go into other people's countries telling them that without any understanding of what is going on there. So that is what I believe we need to surface more in terms of how we have historically engaged with those countries, how we engage with those countries now, and then we, the United States people, who have some agency in helping our elected officials create policy, we need to make our voices heard. Our media needs to change the narrative and framing of these stories. And we also need to surface and acknowledge the racial stigmatization that bent in the stories that we see.
And also, what about, you know, I think that's a great question. You know, when we look about, you know, think about the resource drain that's taking place in Africa, you know, conflict. Diamond conflict in Sierra Leone, rare earth minerals being extracted from the continent. China's becoming a major player as well there. But it's the legacy of colonialism when so many Western countries and China come in and they're extracting these resources, but the, you know, the resources, the wealth derived from those resources don't benefit the people. So that context gives us a way of understanding the way resource extraction is sort of a continuing legacy of colonialism today.
And the economic benefits of that.
Right. I mean, Nigeria, the oil that, you know, is a lot of it, you know, so many of these corrupt leaders are set up there and the wealth never drains down to the population. But in spite of that, I don't think we would say that, you know, there is no responsibility that African people and their leadership should be taking there as well. And to that point,
what do you mean?
That, well, for instance, we're looking at the Ebola crisis in Liberia, and there are so many conspiracy beliefs right now that in many ways impede, you know, the treatment, the effective treatment and combating of this disease.
Conspiracy beliefs by whom?
By many. But
where?
I'm saying in Africa
or, right, in some, or here.
I was about to say that, you know, those aren't confined to Africa. When we think about the United States, there are conspiracy beliefs as it relate to autism and that are predominantly in the white community. And there was a study that said that 50%,
vaccines,
right, 50% of Americans have medical conspiracy beliefs. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is not something that's, you know, confined to one segment of the population. But that's the point I wanted to go to. What does the presence of medical conspiracy beliefs mean to how we're going to combat Ebola in this country? And in Africa as well.
Well, I think I had heard, and I don't know if this is true, please correct me if I'm wrong, but there was some resistance in Liberia to folks who were resisting treatment or people coming in to help, not just because of, you know, maybe of some paternalistic offense they were giving, but because they thought they were bringing the disease with them. And there was a lot of, you know, cultural differences that were creating some problems there. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on how the president is handling Ebola and whether he's abiding by your advice or not. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's different because we do have those kind of conspiracies in America, and they do create public health problems. There's a great study in Reason magazine about I don't know if it was whooping cough or something in Southern
mm-hmm.
California,
yes.
very affluent communities
right, right.
that are seeing rise because people aren't having their kids immunized.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we don't see necessarily the manifest, but we're starting to see some of that mm-hmm. here. So it's interesting.
Adar.
You know, this is such a hard topic for me to talk about because of the framing. And I cannot remove what is happening from the historical perspective of what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly people respond to that because there are no conspiracy beliefs without there being some root cause, whether those beliefs are valid now or not. I'm not judging. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that there is always a root cause behind some type of conspiracy soul or conspiracy belief. Transparency is of utmost importance. And when you're talking conspiracy, you're talking about people who have lost trust in a government or in a medical system or in any other system. So the question becomes, how do we as a country get that trust back for groups of people or for the country as a whole? That is the question.
Right, and I think that's a very powerful question. But when I do think about these conspiracy beliefs, I think you're right. We have a tendency to sort of even stigmatize the people that have these beliefs and call them fringe or lunatic. But in fact, there are some bases of reality. You look at the CIA had a vaccination program that they used in order to catch bin Laden. USAID had a program where they were using HIV prevention in Cuba to foment revolution among the Cuban people. And this was just brought out earlier this year. Smallpox, the caller mentioned how, Lord Jeffrey Amherst did, plan along with some of his colleagues to give smallpox blankets to Native Americans. The Tuskegee, the United States Public Health Experiment in Tuskegee, mm-hmm. The syphilis experiment, the United States Public Health Service experiment in Guatemala with syphilis. So there is this history, right?
So is it a conspiracy mm-hmm. if it has happened?
I think that's the question, but you said transparency.
Exactly, mm-hmm. because in those situations, it only came out when there were leaks. Mm-hmm. There was no transparency around that. And so people found out, and they found out having lost relatives mm-hmm. or having lost friends mm-hmm. or seeing what happened in other communities and saying, wow, that could have been my community. Mm-hmm. So again, the lack of transparency mm-hmm. fuels that, but it cannot be a conspiracy if things actually happened.
I don't disagree. But I,
if they actually happened, yeah. You know, that's a long way from saying, the CIA created AIDS or Ebola, mm-hmm. Which is kind of some of the conspiracy theories that are going on now, right. Especially under this administration. I think that's a bit of a stretch.
But if
I
you
understand
have
the distrust, mm-hmm. but at some point,
so
you
how
need
do you
to
deal
not
with
just
that?
Beat it.
So how do we deal with that mistrust? I mean, this history that we're talking about, the history that we talked about earlier in the show, if certain people have a history of abuse, a mm-hmm. history of mistreatment, mm-hmm. then when things like this come along, the trust is not there. So how do we repair it?
And let me just add one thing. Mm-hmm. Right now, what we do is we say, well, the people who have been impacted have to get over it. That's what we say. Mm-hmm. What we don't say is, you know what? We need to take responsibility for implementing systems in which this happened. Mm-hmm. And so let's review and let's revise those systems. No, it's not the people. It is our systems and it is what happened. So let's address that. We don't say that. We say those people over there mm-hmm. who have these conspiracy theories just need to get over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it goes back exactly to the history discussion that we're having. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can teach the reality that there were these incidents. That the we did put Japanese Americans into internment camps. There was the colonialization in the early part of the 20th century that was very damaging. The problem is when you teach it in a way that says, "And it's still going on. Nothing has changed." That's the part where you take it out of the proper historical context and you perpetuate this sort of thing as something that's believable. That's why I think in the you can teach about the strife without putting in the context that. And it's still all the same, or this makes the case that this is what, America is or isn't.
I mean, but when you say it's not the same, I mean, these revelations about the CIA vaccination program, the revelation about what happened in Cuba with USAID, these happened in the past 3 to 4 years.
No, but they weren't spreading a disease. They were using the guise of helping people to infiltrate. So there was a deception and it was dishonest. That's completely different from mm-hmm. saying that we're brewing up new diseases to kill certain segments of the world population.
No, I don't disagree, but I'm saying isn't the lack of contextualizing and really digging into the roots of what we have done, isn't that preventing and in many ways causing a negative public health response today as it relates to Ebola?
You know what? It is so easy for people who are privileged, for those of us who are privileged, to say, oh, but it's not like we're going around spreading diseases for everybody. Mm-hmm. We're just going around doing stuff for some people. You know, it's so easy for us to say and for us to tell people you should not feel the way that you feel. And of course they should. You know, of course, if you were impacted, of course you're going to feel that way. And it's also hard to say that things are not going on when you are in communities in which things are going on.
So closing thoughts, we have less than a minute. How do we combat this, especially in light of the way history is being taught in our classrooms?
Well, I think the answer is, and maybe we could agree on this, is you got to put it all out there. You have to think critically. From every perspective, you can't accept anything at face value, and teach kids especially to think critically and put it all in context and let people make those decisions for themselves.
Adar?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that transparency is key, and I think not pretending that those people that are affected are the ones with the problem. We need to stop concentrating on so-called broken people and start concentrating on our broken systems and on repairing them.
Well, I'd like to thank our guests here in the studio today, Adar Yira with Associated Black Charities and Baltimore Racial Justice Action, and Greg Klein with Red Maryland.
Thank you
for being in the studio for this discussion today. We have to take a very short break, but stay tuned for the next hour. We're going to listen back to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives about a controversial essay called Baltimore, You're Breaking My Heart. We'll discuss Baltimore's image, what that has to do with the perception and reality of crime in our city, and how racism and gentrification fit into the picture. On our way to break, we're hearing from Rivers of Babylon as performed by Boney M. Bobby Farrell of Boney M. was born on this day in 1949.